Good morning and happy Halloween out there. Welcome to the first hour of Focus 580. My name is Rita Schulte and I'm sitting in this morning for David Inge. The producers for Focus 580 are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal is our associate producer. Our technical director today is Jason Croft. The number to call in our call-in show today is 333-9455 or, if you're out of the area code, 800-222-9455. This morning we are visiting with Barbara Walrath, who spoke to us a few weeks ago, actually. She was our guest on a Focus 580 program, and we decided to bring her back. As a brief introduction, Barbara writes the word columns that appear on the back page of the Atlantic Monthly. Now, those are Word Court and Word Fugitive. She also writes a weekly syndicated newspaper column about language. She is also the author of three books, Word Court, Your Own Words, and Word Fugitives. Now, today what we'd like to do is many times we talk about pet peeve with words and cranky things that make us a little bit off about language usage. Today, though, we want to do something kind of fun and talk about the words we make up and the kinds of things that sort of pop up all over the place that we maybe decide describes the situation better than standard English or a word in the dictionary. And so if you'd like to join in on that conversation, I hope you'll give us a call at 333-9455. And welcome, Barbara. Thanks for coming back.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Oh, great. You know, I think we started this conversation a little bit toward the end of your last visit, and the time came to an end when we were speaking about made-up words. So we really didn't finish it, and I thought it might be kind of fun to come back and readdress that subject.
Well, good idea. Mm-hmm. And today is a particularly good day for it because it's made-up words are very much a children's topic as well as an adult's topic, and Halloween is more of a day for children than it is for adults.
Yes, indeed. And I was speaking with Martha about it one time, and we were thinking about how often some of these things get made up, and usually it is with little ones. And I always thought that, I mean, my theory, which is never right, it's, you know, usually skirts reality, is that many, many times the youngsters in our life have an unfortunate tendency to use the right word at the wrong time. And so we have a tendency to sort of create language that is meaningful to us and the child, but say at the middle of the quiet place in the sermon would not offend. And I know that there's a lot of language that gets started that way. At least if you have small children in your life, you probably, people out there probably are pretty familiar with the situation. But there are other times as well.
Well, when you think about how all of us must have learned language, and scientists have confirmed this, it isn't that you've heard every single version of every single word, like television, televisions, radio, radios, glass, glasses. You get that. And then if the plural of child is children, you can expect a child to say child's the first time, because they've learned what the regular rule is, and then they get corrected. So they learn all the regular verb forms. I singed, you'd say, if you were just learning the language, and then somebody would say, no, dearie, it's sang.
And then your head spins around a little bit.
Well, it's a lot of fun to hear the rules that kids come up with in own minds for the language, and then realize, oh yeah, that is how it, quote, should be if English made any sense.
Well, one of the words in our house that has just lived longer than it probably should have, and now that my children are adults, they're still using it. They wore school uniforms, which included a jumper and a blouse, and they had more than one blouse, and you can see probably here where this is going to go. The little ones, when she was very little, was, it's, I don't have enough blice for the week. I'm like, okay, how do we deal with this one? And you say, no, it's blouses. She goes, no, mouse, mice, blouse, blice, house, heist.
Right. Absolutely.
Oh, sure. And it made perfect sense, and it was a wonderful Dr. Seuss moment. But it was a it was three rounds and a TKO with the second grade teacher. I can tell you, trying to at least purge it during the hours of 7:30 and 3. So it was okay at home, but not outside the house necessarily.
Now, I'm not sure about Blythe. This is a new one, and your kids invented it. But there's this fascinating level of language, words that people keep inventing over and over and over again. And they think it's their word, but it isn't. A lot of people know it, and they all think they invented it.
Oh, sure.
It never turns up in dictionaries because it's just an informal coinage. A couple that kids often come up with are lasterday instead of yesterday and rainbrella instead of umbrella. Those are things that little kids coin. And then people have asked me over and over again for the word fugitives column. Shouldn't there be a word for nephews and nieces collectively, like there is brothers and sisters and siblings? So there are several different variants of what gets coined, but my favorite is nibblings.
Yeah, I like that one.
Well, a lot of people have invented it, and they all think they, you know, I mean, they did invent it, but it's kind of interesting that it just never turns up as an official word in the language.
Yeah, you would think that somewhere along the line, somebody would have, at least in a law court, needed something that would have covered that. Fortunately, there's plenty of folks out there who are willing to take that on. I think one of my favorite kid words that I heard was in the fall when the monarch butterflies go through. The little ones in the daycare center were referring to them as flutterbys.
And it makes a lot more sense, doesn't it?
Sure it does.
What does a butterfly have to do with butter?
Right. That was perfectly illogical. We do have a caller, our first caller this morning on line number one. Thank you. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
There's a word that we have invented in our family. It's progrestinate.
Define, please.
That is when you make progress on something that's not very consequential in order to procrastinate from doing something that you really should do but don't want to do. So you make progress on other things.
I know that feeling. I've been there. That's what's called a portmanteau word, a term that was invented by Lewis Carroll in Alice in Wonderland. And what a portmanteau is has been lost to history. It's an old kind of suitcase that had two different compartments in it. So a portmanteau word takes two words like progress and procrastinate in this case and crunches them together to make a new word. Chortle is another example, chuckle and snort. You've coined a wonderful portmanteau word.
Oh, I have one that has three words put together.
Okay.
But this applies only to our house. We added on a second story to our house. We had flat roofs, and we had neither a garbage... people would give us a hard time about doing this because our kids are grown. Why are you adding on to your house? And I finally said... Well, we have neither a garage, nor a basement, nor an attic, and this is our garbatic. And people understand immediately because you need those things. Then another one that I have, which is more useful to other people, is calendrically impaired.
Uh-oh.
That's for those of us who forget meetings and things like that because they're on, like, the first Monday or the first Tuesday of the month or whatever. I suffer from this impairment and sometimes forget to show up at something because I haven't figured out when it is.
Aren't you tempted to call yourself challenged rather than impaired?
Challenged is good, yeah.
It's a little warmer.
Yes. No, I don't know. Somehow impaired. Calendrically challenged. I guess that's more... I'm thinking in terms of how it rolls off the tongue. But thank you. Anyway, those are my contributions.
Excellent. Excellent. That's an example of function shift where you start with a noun that's calendar, and at this point it's been turned into an adverb, calendrically.
We do that a lot. You hear that frequently in advertising and in people struggling to be politically correct or unoffensive. And then they end up being permanently ingrained in conversation, vertically challenged, or, you know, something along those lines. They tend to live a longer life than it's really a good idea sometimes, I think. But it's they're kind of fun when you make them up yourself.
Yeah, I think for the most part, those are, well, the ones you make up are, tend to be jokes.
Mm-hmm. I thought, like this last one, though, because many of us are having a very difficult time making the Outlook calendar work, so I think we can put that word to use.
Oh, I've got my iPhone calendar. I love my iPhone.
Really?
You have to press the button, save, and then done, or the appointment disappears.
Oh, wicked.
Yeah, this is scary.
That's just wicked. I want to remind everybody that our phone number is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you're calling long distance. And we're speaking today with Barbara Walraff, and we're talking about made-up languages, the words that you make up that just seem to describe the situation or the thing you're looking at so much better than anything that anyone else has used. And aren't you clever for having made it up? One of the I had noticed, I don't know when it finally came to the top of my mind, but there's a series of commercials for a phone company out there. I noticed the commercial long before I realized what they were trying to sell, that is putting the pieces of place names together to identify how overly networked the person who needs this telephone service is.
I've seen that too, and if anybody who's on that ad campaign is listening, it's a bad idea, don't you think? It just doesn't really quite add up.
I don't know that it works all that well, but yet when you look at the age of the people who are featured in the commercials, it occurs to me that younger folks tend to grab onto that pretty quickly, the 20-somethings, and place things together. Particularly in some sort of odd little argo that's kind of going on, particularly where internet is concerned.
Good point.
And I'm wondering if that commercial just isn't for me, which is why, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Whenever a word is intended to signal to some subgroup, hey, this is for you, it also signals to other groups, hey, this isn't for you.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I spend so much time trying to parse out what places they're talking about that I completely, you know, I can't tell you what company it is. It took a while for me to realize that it was a phone company. So I was having too much fun trying to figure out what pieces of geography those are that they've
put
together.
The known thing about advertising is sort of the more clever the ad, the more, hey, look at me, the ad is. So mm-hmm. Less people realize who the ad is for.
Right. Well, there was, my favorite was a classic that talked about herding cats. It was a beautiful piece of work. I have no idea what it was for. But it was very, very, very clever.
Well, you know, and herding cats has entered the language, but I have to tell you, I have 3 cats and they are not at all difficult to herd.
Really?
So I don't know what they're talking
about. Well, I'm part of the executive staff of a 7-pound cat, and she's she's not all that easy.
Well, that's a little cat.
Yes, it is a little cat, but she's fast and she's wiry. One of the interesting things I noticed, I think, I don't know whether we talked about this the last time you were here or not, but there's a interesting tendency of science words to slip into the language, and I want to kind of walk down that path a little bit on how people add those things in to make words, but we have a call from Germantown Hills on line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a word I'd like you to make up.
Uh-oh.
Well, it's not. It would be very useful.
Mm-hmm.
We're in our 60s, and we have a number of delightful grandchildren, and there are other couples with whom we share these grandchildren. And I can't think of a word to describe the several other couples with whom we share grandchildren. And I think we need a word for that relationship. Do you know of one, or would you like to make one up?
Well, they have them in other languages. Would you rather Spanish or Yiddish?
Is there one in Spanish? I don't know it, of course.
Consuegros.
Con?
Suegros.
C-O-N-F-R-E.
S as in Sam.
Oh.
E-G as in goat. R-O-S. Consuegros.
Consuegros.
And I think it has something to do with sangre, blood.
That's what
you share blood.
That's what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. I tried to look in all my dictionaries, French, Swedish, German. I couldn't find anything like that. I never tried this one.
Well, this is more the whole extended family. It's not exactly you and the fellow, your
the other
fellow grandparents.
Don't care, grandchildren.
This comes up when couples are getting married and their parents suddenly think, oh, wait a minute, I guess now we're related, so what are we?
Uh-huh.
And that's the context in which I first heard consuegras, but it's broader than that. I think in Tagalog, the Philippine language, it's called...
It's Philippine.
Ballet, B-A-L-A-E. And Yiddish has machatunim.
The problem with all three words is that they don't...
Nobody's going to know what you're talking
well,
about.
Well, no, and they don't sound good in English, I don't think. You can't say them easily in English.
I know. And it is funny that English, and there's a Russian... I mean, there most languages that I know of seem to have something for those kinds of relationships, and why English doesn't, I don't know.
Well, I don't think are the most commonly known Western European languages... other than your account of Spanish, they don't have a word for that, because I'm pretty familiar with Scandinavian languages above all, but also with French, and I've checked it out in German. I don't find it anywhere there. So it's a concept that, for whatever reason, Western Europeans and their descendants in this country have not felt a need to express with a word.
It's a really interesting thing that some of the words we need most, we just keep wanting to coin and still don't have. And I thought maybe where you were going with this, but there you are, married.
Well, there are two other words that we need and don't use. Swedish and Norwegian have a word that means a 24-hour period, and that works out very well in travel planning. It's Dön, D-O with an umlaut, G-N in Norwegian. That's very handy.
And gay doesn't?
No, because this is a 24-hour period. What if you're, we're going to arrive at 6 p.m. and we're going to stay for 24 hours. We're going to stay one day. It's not clear whether you're staying the next day or, you know, are you leaving the morning, the very next morning, the morning after. This expression in Scandinavian languages works out real well. There's another word that we don't have. I heard described in an English humor program one time that I thought was hilarious. We all know the word for the word charisma, for someone who walks into a room and everybody immediately notices their presence. He said, we don't have a word for the person who walks into a room and nobody notices that they came in. He said, we need the word charisma. That's always...
There you go. There's a nice portmanteau word.
Yeah. Well, I'll see what I can find about consegros, and the Yiddish word is just beyond the capabilities of my ear and tongue to deal with. So.
Well, now you're saying this, and I'm realizing that I don't know whether that word ever got checked out with dictionaries. I'm relying on people who say, oh, I speak Spanish, and here's the word that I know. So if you don't find it in the dictionary, don't blame me.
What you're saying is it's a word for extended family, and I was looking for something really specific.
Yeah, that we don't have that.
Something that we could render by co-grandparents, but that doesn't fall lightly from my tongue.
Mm-hmm. No.
Well, nice talk. Thanks for the chance to talk.
Okay, thank you.
I appreciate this
Absolutely.
Kind of show and this kind of playing around with language ideas.
Well, great. Thank you. We have another caller on a cell phone in Champaign on line number one. Welcome.
Hey, welcome. I have one that was probably not an original, but back in the old high school days, in a state where you like someone, but you don't want to say that you love them, we called it loke. I loke you.
Oh, sort of an evolutionary process going on there.
You said that to someone and they said, what back?
Yeah, my high school girlfriend and I were in that state for about 30 days, and then we said, okay, we love each other now, so it's okay. I don't think I would be the first one to come up with that word, but that's my word for you.
New to me.
Yeah.
It's new to me. It's a good one.
Yeah. See if it's sticky. If it has, what is that? It's a business term now. Something is sticky. It's going to last, or it has legs.
Has legs.
Mm-hmm.
As a synonym for sticky, it's kind of an odd yes. mental image, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I keep hearing people talk about concepts that are sticky. And, you know, I immediately get a picture of peanut butter and honey or flypaper or something like that. And then it's just sort of like, it's not something you really want to incorporate, but it's just sort of stuck to you and you're kind of going to have to deal with it, sort of a thing. But and on the other hand, it does kind of express what they're trying to say.
This is a slightly different concept because it's a word that has existed, you know, it's an old word, it's not a new word at all, but suddenly it's being applied to a new situation. And sometimes that helps the new usage be understood because mm-hmm. you know what sticky means. And when you say, well, it's a sticky idea, mm-hmm. we know perfectly well that we're not talking about peanut butter.
Right.
Really. So really. How can an idea be like that?
Right. But, you know, if you have a flight of fancy sort of mind like I have in a meeting sometime, it kind of goes down that track. Maybe it shouldn't. But it's one of the things that I find interesting is how people will take, I don't know if these are portmanteau words. Martha did a little internet search, and I went looking for some myself, and she came up with some better ones. Botox, BEAUTOX. What a girl or woman suffers after a bad, prolonged exposure to her boyfriend. And yeah. It's just sort of an interesting play on sound more than anything else.
Those, I don't quite approve of that one because it's what you call an irrelevant allusion, not mm-hmm. a pun. I mean, and I get a lot of those. In the word fugitives column, what just happened, asking for a word that doesn't exist but that your caller needs, mm-hmm. feels a need for, people write in and ask for, oh, please, I need a word for something or other. And then other readers try to help them out and send me coinages. The ones that I tend to like don't refer. If you're talking about your boyfriend, unless it has something to do with cosmetic procedures, you know, a boyfriend who doesn't think you're nice looking enough and need. You know, then Botox kind of makes sense, but what it has to do with the injectable, mm-hmm. I don't know. So it kind of sends your mind off on a wrong path.
Right. I want to remind everyone out there who's listening that we are speaking with Barbara Walriff, and we are talking about made-up words, things that you sort of needed just because the word that was maybe in standard usage just didn't describe the situation quite right, or maybe there wasn't a word for it, so you made one up on the spot. Our phone number to call is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Our guest today writes the word columns that appear on the back page of the Atlantic Monthly, and she is the author of three books, Word Court, Your Own Words, and Word Fugitives. Barbara Walriff has been with you've been with the Atlantic Monthly for a while, haven't you?
For, I think it must be 23, 24 years, because mm-hmm. I got there shortly after the Atlantic's 125th Ooh. Anniversary and mm-hmm. was sort of disappointed to have missed the party.
Uh-oh.
So I remember that, and next month it's the 150th anniversary.
Well, happy birthday, Atlantic Monthly.
Well, thank you.
Well, I guess so.
Yeah.
Now, our conversation today is about made-up words, and I think maybe we have one on a call from a caller on line number one in Danville. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm enjoying your program very much.
Great.
The word I have is one I borrowed from the Word Addict site. Have you seen that? Word a dictionary, W-E-R-D, where people can send in the kind of words you're talking about.
Yeah.
And the one from, I think, yesterday, which appealed to me, was yesessarily. If someone says to you, yes, if someone says to you, not necessarily, you can say, yes-a-cerily.
That's a good special purpose word.
Yeah.
Yes, I thought so, too. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Continue. I'm enjoying to listen.
Thanks.
Thank you. We have a caller on line number two from Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I need a word.
Uh-oh.
And maybe you know it, or maybe somebody else can suggest one. When I write to my nieces and nephews, to my nibblings.
That's good, good, good.
With this older person's good advice, it's not avuncular, because I'm not their uncle. Is there a word for good advice from an older aunt?
You say aunt out there. Here in New England, we tend to say aunt.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If you say aunt, then ancular doesn't work at all, because it sounds like something about ankles. But if you say oncular.
Oncular. Okay. That's a possibility. Thank you very much.
You're welcome for what that's worth. Something that's really interesting about made-up words is the words, there are some of the most needed words in the language that we've needed for at least 50 years, because I found an article in the New York Times Magazine saying that most of these didn't exist 50 years ago. We still don't have. Things like a dignified word for a grown-up boyfriend or girlfriend.
Right.
You don't think of yourself as a boy or a girl, so the person that you're going out with, you want to introduce as your, and people come up with postal cue or partner, and just nothing sticks.
Mm-hmm.
None of them is sticky enough.
Sticky, yes.
The mother of all of these is the singular he or she pronoun.
Oh, yes.
Did you know that in Webster's Third, when it came out in, circa 1960, I'm bad with dates, they threw in a word that had been proposed for that?
No.
And it's there in the dictionary, but it never caught on. And you can see why when I tell you what it is. It's fawn.
Fawn.
I don't, T-H-O-N, fawn. I don't know why somebody thought that would work, but instead of saying when the new employee is hired, we'll give him or her a introduction to all the people he or she is going to work with, you'd say give fawn an introduction to all the people fawn is going to work with.
That's just ugly.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's just ugly.
There's a lot that's ugly in English that we just accept because it's already there, but try to add something in like that, and nope, it just doesn't happen.
It sounds like a kind of shoe.
Yeah. I need to track down who thought of that bright idea.
Yeah, who thought that was a good idea? Okay. We've got a caller on line number three. Hello.
Hi. Calling on my way to Chicago, and we have a herd of cats, like you mentioned.
Uh-huh.
And you know when you get a fat, friendly cat, turn it down, and you knock it over to rub its belly, and it kind of helps you knock itself over?
Mm-hmm.
We call that whipping, W-B-W-I-P, whip.
Okay.
And that's kind of the sound and the scent that when they kind of help you knock themselves over so you can rub their belly,
uh-huh.
whip the cat. And the other is we combine two phrases. I have a Mexican husband, and he says, chill your horses, instead of hold your horses, which is actually more intense and makes more sense than just holding them. So when we have to calm the kids down, we tell them to chill their horses. Hmm. And I'm going to get offline now so I can listen.
It's a portmanteau phrase.
Yeah. That's a nice one.
Very nice.
Chill your horses.
I think we need an entire segment devoted, we need an entire other program devoted to words invented for animals, because animal lovers need all kinds of words.
Oh, yeah. Because animals are so expressive if you understand them. I love people who say, oh, cats don't have any expression. Like, really?
Yeah.
She can tell me when she's disdainful pretty easily. A lot of times it has to do with the ears and the tail, but... We have another caller on line number one in Urbana.
Hi, I'm back. Another portmanteau word, and I don't know if others have used it or whether I came up with it, it's guesstimate.
Oh, yeah, I hear that one from time
guesstimate.
To time. Guesstimate.
Yeah, it's somewhere between a guess and an estimate. I sometimes use it when I'm doing genealogy, and I'm trying to get some idea of when, for instance, when somebody lived, so I know what records to look for, but I don't really have a firm date.
Hmm.
So I make a guess and an estimate based on other facts, like when they had children. You know that they're not going to have children when they're 10 or after they're 50, so you can get some idea of an age range or birth date range from other facts in somebody's life.
Interesting.
But then I label it that it's my guesstimate based on what.
You know, this is exactly how English changes for real, that a word like a halfway between mm-hmm. guess and estimate, people find that useful. And I have heard that, so you're not the only person to have coined it.
Well,
so then eventually you'll get guesstimate as a word in the language that starts appearing in dictionaries, and then people will do something else with it, and off it goes.
Somewhere in a novel, I saw the word per, as in a short for person. It might have been a book by Marge Piercy. I forget. It was a futuristic science fiction sort of thing, speculative fiction sort of thing, where I think in that particular case, maybe the sex of an individual was indeterminate. But I could be wrong about that. But I thought it was an interesting term because we could use it for him or her, per for person. It's shorter than him or her.
So as a pronoun.
And it wouldn't be mistaken for thong, T-H-O-N-G, which thon would. And I had never heard of thon, but...
Nobody's heard of thon. It's weird.
It does sound like a pair of underpants.
Oh, yeah. That or shoes. Back to the clothing.
Well, you know, if we can clip television to TV and telephone to phone, there's no reason that person to purr. But the difference here is that you're using it as a different part of speech, so it's now a pronoun.
Right.
Handy idea.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller on line number 2 in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to point out that when I was growing up in the 50s, there was not a word sibling that was in common usage because they very much wanted one. And I had to say my sister and brothers, because I had two brothers and one sister, so I couldn't just say my brothers and sisters, and I found that very cumbersome.
You know, that's interesting, because that article from the New York Times Magazine of 50 years ago that I mentioned, one of the ones on that the author of that had a list of words, and one of them was exactly that, and I thought, oh, what was wrong with sibling? So I was kind of making fun of that, but you're saying it wasn't in common use.
No.
Interesting.
I can't tell you when it started to be, but I've been grateful ever since. But I know the last 20, maybe 30 years it's been around, but 50 years ago, it wasn't available to me at any rate, because 50 years ago I was in high school, and it wasn't there.
Interesting.
I didn't grow up in the sticks. I grew up right outside Detroit. So anyway, and then as far as the gentleman who called in, about the grandparent situation, I just call the other couple my co-parents-in-law or my co-grandparents. And that works. It's not as, you know, it doesn't slip off your tongue as easily as sibling or nibbling, but it works.
He was complaining about that because it didn't trip lightly off the tongue. I don't think he wanted to use that, but I agree with you. It gets the idea across.
Mm-hmm. Right. Anyway. Well, that's all I had to say.
Well, thank you.
One of the more interesting words that partial words, I guess it is, that has crept into the language with meaning to people because of the Internet is Wiki, W-I-K-I, Wikipedia. and wiki conversant people. And I heard this conversation in the hallway here at WILL between two staff members. They were talking about a kind of wiki enabled person, or people who are comfortable with that sort of structure. And when in the world did that move past just a simple title of an online encyclopedia? It seems like it's creeping.
Probably a little bit later than Google turned into a verb. No, I Googled him the other day.
Right.
Did you wiki that?
Yeah.
But of course, wiki cuts. We're not supposed to believe everything it says. Mm-hmm. At least not yet. That
right.
It's continually a work in progress.
But it all by itself, somebody came up with it. And I thought when I went looking, and of course I managed to lose that particular piece of paper in this, snowstorm of white paper I have in front of me here that talks about the origin of Wikipedia. There's a little article that the people who started the whole thing out wrote about why they selected that. And I'm blanking on it right now, but it seemed like they crafted it out of things. And now I'm not remembering that completely.
Well, the use that you're reporting where people were talking in the hallway, do you remember, did it sound complimentary or did it sound...
Well, I think it was just, it was not negative. I think in general it was sort of along the lines of some people are comfortable using that and some people are not. Some people like the idea of collaborative information and some people don't. And it wasn't, I don't think the conversation was placing a value on it so much as just the fact that people are falling on one side or the other of whether this is a useful or reliable tool.
I could imagine wiki being used in all different kinds of ways. Like you could say contemptuously, oh, that's just a wiki fact.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like that's just a factoid.
Right.
Although factoid has become a little more complimentary than it was when it started out as not really a fact.
Right. It's something somebody kind of made up. And yeah, I remember the days when factoid was sort of a lesser cousin to reality.
Yeah, it related to humanoid and, mm-hmm. and which is something like a human but not a human.
Right. Yeah. That maybe that's the feeling. But no, this wasn't the feeling that I got from just passing by this conversation. But I thought it was interesting that we've used Wikipedia here a number of times because it's pretty good at giving you some decent information about popular culture and technical popular culture.
Yeah, I'm sounding like I'm down on Wikipedia, and I'm not.
I
use it myself. It's a
right.
fascinating...
Yeah, and you know, I like the way it's kind of linked all over the place. And just out of context, I thought, well, it was interesting the way the prefix was being used to describe a particular method for gathering information and for disseminating it. I thought, well, that's interesting that it has gone from, it's elevated itself to the status now of when somebody says, like you just mentioned, I Googled somebody, you know exactly what somebody did, right from step A through Z, you know what was going on there. And it's now become something that when you say something is kind of wiki, you know, that a lot of people kind of went together to put it together and they accept the fact that there's errors and they're inviting you to take a look at it and see if you can spot them. Not as a gotcha game, but as a fix it, make it better game.
Yeah,
I think that's
you can
interesting.
Collaborate too.
Mm-hmm. I have a caller here on line number 4 from Charleston. Good morning.
Yes, very interesting, ladies. Mm-hmm. I have heard this word, I hope I'm not the second to say it, but from my niece and a TV program with a preteen boy. And they were using it, and my niece is a school teacher, ginormous.
Oh, yes.
Has anybody else brought that up yet? I've been listening, you know, I'm working around and didn't had anyone else... introduce that.
I saw that in print somewhere mm-hmm. recently, and I've forgotten why.
Well, it's a marriage of two words, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Giant and enormous, but ginormous.
Yep.
I thought from a school teacher of second who teaches second grade, mm-hmm. she may have heard it from one of those. But anyway, that is my contribution. But mm-hmm. I begin to hear it a little more around. So mm-hmm. okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. It's one of my California daughter's favorite expressions for You know, like, that is the most ginormous meal I have ever had. That's like Blythe in our household, and I don't know when she brought it to us, but it's kind of permeated like perfume through the entire language.
Well, it's a really interesting habit that the language has of, you use a word like enormous, and it's a whole lot, enormous is a whole lot bigger than big.
Right.
So something is enormous. And then when you're used to saying enormous and you really want to express, no, really, really, really enormous, you have to create something new.
Yeah. Our my technical director here, Jason Croft, just sent us an instant message that said Merriam-Webster just added ginormous to their dictionary.
Well, there you go.
Spelled G-I-N-O-R-M-O-U-S. I'll expect to see that on the next spelling bee. Along with all of those other combinations of letters that I can't even begin to imagine are words. We have a caller on line number one. Hello.
Hi. I've been interested in putting a P on words that start with R-E. Or taking it off on ones that just start with pre, as in preemptive. It'll be reemptive and emptive, whatever those kind of words are. And two of these things, which are kind of the fool's golden rule, but do it first, you know, would be pretaliation and pretribution. And, of course, there's the pre-action, action, everything, those two go together. And one that's pretty hard to say because it's so close to a word we have is prelevant.
Prelevant.
Prelevant?
Prelevant. You know, it's relevant, but in advance.
I want to hear you use that in a sentence where I understand the need for it.
I don't have the need.
Or it could be just prevailing relevance.
Yes. Well, and it's fun to take the re off of certain words, and the word, well, there's prevent and vent, I mean, entirely different things.
We have someone on staff, I wish I could remember who it was so I could credit them properly, mentioned if I can be disgruntled, can I be gruntled?
Why, I just answered that question for my newspaper column last week.
Excellent!
And I had thought, off the top of my head, and this is why I don't answer people for the newspaper column individually, because I so often get it wrong if I'm just off the top of my head. Off the top of my head, I said, well, once upon a time, there was gruntled and disgruntled, and then we just didn't need gruntled because we've got pleased and
so there really was a gruntled.
Well, actually, there was, but it wasn't the opposite of disgruntled. It's some really peculiar kind of dis that I don't think there are any living examples, although the Oxford English Dictionary has some obsolete examples, really peculiar kind of dis that meant very.
Huh.
And gruntle was to make a grunting sound, and it was said of animals in just a kind of factual way and of people as like grunting with pleasure. So somebody who is disgruntled, I'm not making this up, I know it sounds crazy, who is disgruntled was like, you know, was gruntling a whole lot. It was not just, well, I guess we'd say happy as a clam, but clams are quieter.
Yes, but they're always smiling. So it's not like a Sasquatch word that, you know, maybe filtered in and out and people saw it for a while or used it for a while and then it disappeared. It actually started out as something else and then it got preempted by disgruntled and disappeared.
The history of the language is just a long history of kind of mistaken identity. Somebody thinks a word means something, and they use it that way, and then pretty soon everybody's using it that way, and then that's what it means.
Ooh.
How democratic
the
language is really wonderful.
And we have, before we go any further, we have a caller on line number two. From Arcola, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question which your station uses regularly, and I've heard it a few other times on a meaning of a word, and it's. But I have also asked some of my very more accomplished music people, and it's symphonia. What is symphonia?
In context of...
What does it mean? What kind of instruments? What kind of... Is it small group, big group? How does it... how do you distinguish what is a symphonia from a symphony to a, you know, a work done by a symphonia?
If you hear little typing sounds coming from here, that's because I've got, five dictionaries on my hard drive, and I don't know whether everybody knows you can do that, but gosh, it's easier than getting up out of your chair and flipping through all those pages.
Oh, certainly.
I didn't find it in the American Heritage.
Well, it's used a lot on our radio station here. And
on the classical side, yes?
Yes. And I, being a musician myself, I don't know that. I'm of old school, I guess.
I can see the person who would know, but he's in another studio announcing on the FM and is inaccessible. I know that Sinfonia de Camera is a local assembling of musicians that play.
So it's a name.
Well,
of their group.
It's the name of their group is the Sinfonia de Camera. But I don't know whether it's a word in standard English or in the music dictionary or not.
It might be a specialized music term that wouldn't turn up in just a regular dictionary. I just Googled it, and I found in the Urban Dictionary Tales of Sinfonia, which is a real-time 3D battle system. But I don't think that's what you're talking about.
No, I don't think so.
Well,
but
when you get a chance to ask him, will you then announce it, or I'm listening?
Well, if what we can do is maybe, how about this? Let's ask Jason if he wouldn't mind taking your phone number. We will ask Vic and, you know what? Jason is calling Vic. So when we get the answer, we will announce it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thanks. Okay, I have a caller on line number one from Champaign.
Hello.
Hi.
Apropos of Sinfonia, I think that it's simply, I may be wrong. I frequently am. I think it's Italian for symphony or symphony orchestra. But but I would like to think that it is wicked music, sinfonia.
Oh.
On the other hand, apropos of your gruntlement over disgruntled, back in the late 50s, early 60s, there was a brief life of a phrase, keep gruntled, as in stay happy. So it was used much more recently than your dictionary shows.
Well, after the whole dis meaning very was just forgotten to history, then people started using gruntle to be the opposite of disgruntle, and that goes back to the 1930s. I think P.G. Woodhouse had Bertie Wooster being gruntled. So that's an example of something that used to mean one thing coming back and being something else. And you know what? I just looked at the American Heritage Dictionary online and found sinfonia, spelled with an like S-I-N, as in wicked music, and that has a definition here. An instrumental composition serving as an overture as to an opera or cantata, especially in the 18th century. And then more broadly, a symphonic composition. So, yes, you're right that it's Italian, and it's from Italian, and that's what it means in English.
Yeah. Your discussion of disgruntled reminds me, by the way, of an exchange that a friend of mine and I, when we were kids, tried to write a story in which we backformed positives from words that seemed to exist only as negatives, like, as sequitur after sipid sequitur dropped ainly from his lips, things like that. And there are hundreds and hundreds. Your earlier caller about emptying.
You were writing this when you were a kid.
Yeah.
Very good.
I was crazy. What can I tell you?
Well, that's impressive. Impressive kind of crazy.
No guarantee that I'm not still. But another interesting phenomenon that I've noticed just in the last couple of years is the whomevering.
Oh, yes.
The the notion that somehow or other whoever must be wrong, and people throwing in the M and making it an objective case, even when the whomever is actually the subject of its clause.
Well, of all people, Sapphire said any sentence that has a whom in it ought to be revised, which surprised me coming from him.
What did he say?
He said any sentence that has a whom in it ought to be revised.
This is from William Sapphire?
Yeah. Doesn't it sound un-Sapphire-like, to coin a word?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And the last word on Sinfonia de Camera, spelled S-I-N-F-O-N-I-A. It's a chamber orchestra composed of musicians from throughout the Midwest, founded by music director Ian Hobson. That's our local context. And Vic DiGeronimo on our FM side refer to it, verifies yet again that it is a short orchestral piece that was played before the opera overture, and it does indeed come from the Italian. So this was a sort of a wiki effort, I guess, maybe, although I don't think we need to make any adjustments or changes.
Was tricky about that was it sounded like symphonia, and symphonia with an M, and symphonia sound an awful lot alike, and in English, who knows whether it's got a Y or an I in it.
Right.
So you try to look it up in the dictionary under S-Y-M, you're nowhere near where you're going to find it.
And I think that's just the unfair part of English, that my mother always used to do that to me. So how do I spell pneumonia, Mom? She goes, look it up in the dictionary. Well, thank you. We're coming to an end here, and we've had, this has been fun, a lot of fun, and I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope you'll come back again sometime and visit with us, Barbara.
Well, thank you. Yes, I'd love to.
Great. I want to thank our callers and also our technical director, Jason Croft, who so ably handled a couple of questions there for us, and Vic, who came up with some answers, and also Celeste Quinn, who ran in with some information about the Sinfonia, and our producers of Focus 580, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal.